If you need help getting Social Security disability benefits, then this podcast is for you. Give me 15 minutes and I'll pull back the curtain on disability and reveal the secrets to winning I've learned over the past 25 plus years. Hi, I'm Jonathan Ginsberg, and I'm a practicing Social Security disability lawyer. I want to help deserving claimants just like you win the benefits you deserve and not one penny less. Now, if you already know you need help today, go to ssdanswers.com for a free and confidential evaluation of your case. It takes just 2 minutes. That's ssdanswers.com, and I'd love to hear from you. Now, let's start the show. Hi there, this is Jonathan Ginsberg, and welcome back to the Social Security Disability Podcast. I'm recording this at the beginning of 2020, and I'd like to take a few minutes to offer you my analysis of the state of Social Security disability in 2020, what trends I'm seeing, and what we might expect going forward this year and into the next. So let me start by saying that trends in Social Security disability, like in any other area of law, are cyclical. Sometimes the trends favor one side, and other times they favor a different side. I've been in practice, in law practice, for 30 years, and I've seen this time and time again. I do, besides Social Security disability, I've handled bankruptcy cases in the personal bankruptcy Chapter 7, Chapter 13 world. There are some times where the laws and the policies are very favorable towards debtors, other times towards creditors. It just goes back and forth. The same thing applies in workers' compensation, estate planning, you name the area, criminal defense, you name the area, there's going to be cycles. And that is certainly true in the Social Security disability world. Now, right now, I've got to tell you, regretfully, that the trend in the Social Security disability world is very much against claimants, against people who are applying for disability. There is a narrative in Congress that the Social Security disability system is rigged, it's riddled with fraud, and that claimants and their attorneys are robbing the American taxpayer. That's what is going on. That's what they think. If you'd like a detailed understanding of what this is, what this looks like, I would tell you to Google the phrase Heritage Foundation and Social Security Disability. The Heritage Foundation is a conservative think tank in Washington, and they publish analysis, policy analysis, and proposals for legislation. They have a great deal of influence on Congresspeople, especially Republican lawmakers, about how to proceed with different law. And what happens is these representatives and senators read this, and they accept it as being true. And just to give you an idea, and I'm not going to go through the entire proposal, but if you look at, again, Heritage Foundation and Social Security Disability, you'll see in the first page, this is what they say, that the Social Security Disability Insurance Program is functionally and financially broken. Average wait times are close to 600 days. Almost half of all benefit awards stem from non-medical factors. The system encourages dependence instead of recovery, and fraud and abuse contribute to a lack of integrity and accountability. And it goes on, and they suggest changes that would make qualifying for disability, Social Security disability, a lot harder. They want to privatize it. They want to increase the number of reviews. They want to basically eliminate attorneys from the process so that if you're a claimant and you're applying for benefits, you've got to go to a hearing. You're basically going to go without an attorney. It just goes on and on. It's terrible. This is just ridiculous in my view. And basically, if you read this, you'll understand why many legislators, and really it's on both sides of the aisle, because I think that the Heritage Foundation does have influence amongst some Democrats as well. But if you look at it and you see that there's just a lot of policy, a lot of assumptions that are just not correct, and basically a lot of legislatures accept this nonsense as true. Now, Social Security disability beneficiaries don't really have any lobbyists on their side. There are some think tanks on the other side that have a different view, and they do have some influence amongst Democrat legislators. But at the end of the day, representatives and senators care most about one thing, that's getting reelected and saving money to use it to spend on something else or to make tax cuts on the backs of disabled people does not have much political downside. So Social Security disability recipients are politically not a very powerful group, so it's easy to go after them. And this is really for both sides of the aisle. So don't be surprised if we see things getting worse before it gets better. Now, again, it could change. Obviously, if the composition of the House or the Senate changes, then some of the proposals that have been adopted by Social Security may be slowed down or they may change. But this is the reality we're dealing with. I hate to be pessimistic about this, but I think you need to know the reality that Social Security disability is more or less under attack and that this is going to go on for a while, certainly in 2020. Now, I will say this. In my experience, judges, even some of the newer judges who are actually obligated to make decisions are a lot more reasonable. They're in a hearing room looking at somebody face-to-face who's obviously disabled. The medical record implies that even if the evidence does not line up with all the requirements of Social Security, it keeps adding to the list. And they still are approving cases. And, you know, realize the word judge is both a noun and a verb. Judges are judges. They have a job, but they also have to use judgment. And many judges that I'm coming before will use judgment, and they will see if somebody is clearly disabled, they'll find a way to get them approved. Now, I will say this, that Social Security, in fact, I'm looking at a case right now as I'm recording this where a client, another attorney had recommended, referred it to me. Someone had been approved at a prior hearing. The appeals counsel reversed it. The approval had been issued, and the appeals counsel came in and said, not so fast, we're going to reverse it. They're sending it back for a second hearing because they didn't think the judge used good reasoning. So that can happen too. So this can be very, very frustrating. Even if you win at a hearing, it doesn't happen that often, but it does happen. Even if you win at a hearing, the appeals counsel can come in and say, no, we're going to reverse it, and you're going to have to go fight this all over again. In this particular case, the prior decision, the approval, was issued in 2018. I think it was December of 2018. This poor lady's next hearing is going to be in February of 2020. So basically, she's had to wait over a year after being really close. It was approved. The judge had approved it. Everything was going along. Then all of a sudden, the appeals counsel, just without any warning, boom, we're going to reverse it and send it back. Again, doesn't happen very much, but it does happen. So let's talk specifics about what I see happening, at least in my practice and within the practices of some of the attorneys that I talk to all over the country. I think one thing is we're going to see an increased push for video hearings. Social Security claims that video hearings will help reduce the backlog and allow for people to get in front of a judge sooner, and I think that is true. However, there's a downside to that, and Social Security actually they floated a proposed rule that would eliminate our right as claimants and claimants' attorneys to object to video hearings and insist on a local judge. They tried to get that through. That was rejected. Congress would not go with it. So you can still object to video hearings, and I'm to the point now where I'm doing that. I would much rather have a judge live and in person than a judge appearing by video. And the reason for that is, kind of getting back to what I was talking about before, it's much more difficult if you're a judge looking at somebody who maybe doesn't have a lot of medical records because you've been out of work for 2 years and you have no money, but you're clearly disabled and the judge is going to try to find a way to get to approve you. It's a lot easier to not do that if you're a judge in a video 1,000 miles away. If you're in the same room with somebody, you're looking at them, you sense their suffering, you're using judgment, you're evaluating their believability and their credibility, it's going to be more likely that judge is going to find in your favor. So again, my experience has been that the video judges, not that they're bad people or that they're bad judges, but there is a disconnect when you have a judge 1,000 miles, 1,500 miles away versus a judge in the same room as you. So my recommendation and what I'm doing in my practice is I am objecting to video hearings. I want to have live hearings because, in fact, the backlog in hearings has actually come down a little bit. I'm going to talk about that a little bit later, but I just don't see the need to rush to save a month or two and go with a video judge that I don't know, that we have no ongoing history with, as opposed to a local judge that I'm going to know the way that judge wants things, the way that judge handles his or her hearings, and also put that judge in the same room as somebody so that if my client is really suffering, the judge can sense that. So my feeling is, and my recommendation would be to object to video hearings unless there's really some reason not to. But I'm objecting to all of them now. That's a change. I used to feel like, you know, I wanted to get my clients to their hearings as quickly as possible, but now I've decided that I'd rather have my client in the same room as the judge. All right, a second trend that I'm seeing is judges insisting on, in Social Security at the administrative level, insisting on extensive and current medical records. Now, this ignores some reality, and that is if you, as I said before, if you've been out of work for a year or 2 years, you probably don't have insurance, you probably don't have a lot of money to go to the doctor. And what happens is you get to a hearing and the judge is like, well, why haven't you gone to the doctor? Well, I can't afford it. Well, I can't. How am I supposed to approve you if we have no medical record? It's sort of a catch-22. So what I would tell you is you've got to find a way to get to the doctor. And my feeling is at a minimum, you need to go 4 times a year. And if that means going to the emergency room or going to a local clinic, a low-cost or free clinic, a county extension office, whatever you have to do, you've got to get to the doctor. Gaps in medical records are a big reason why legitimate, viable cases get turned down. I'm not saying it's fair. There's no great answer to this. I'm just telling you, if you don't go to the doctor, we don't have medical records, and it goes on for months or years, that's a really easy way for a judge to say, you know, if you're not going to the doctor, I'm just going to assume you're not in all that much pain, you're not that uncomfortable, you're not getting medicine, I'm just going to deny you. And it's the argument that, well, I can't afford to go to the doctor, it just doesn't really carry much weight. So you've got to find a way. I would also tell you, if you are having financial problems getting to the doctor, and this is one of the things that a lawyer can do for you, despite what our friends at the Heritage Foundation say, I would get non-medical evidence, statements from former coworkers and supervisors about practical problems you were having at a job, statements from friends or relatives even that have seen you over time and have noticed a deterioration in your capacities and your abilities and your thought processes, your emotional stability. These are all things that are non-medical evidence, but they can help build your case. So don't hesitate to use those. Realize Social Security, and this is a positive about Social Security disability, we have in the disability world a relaxed rule of evidence authentication. If you go to state court or superior court or whatever the county court would be where you live, and you have evidence, it's got to be authenticated. The person who issued the evidence may have to come to court and verify that these records are what they say they are, and it gets really complicated and expensive. But in state court, because it's a judicial process, that's required. Social Security, much more relaxed rules of evidence. It's administrative. It's part of the executive branch, not the judicial branch. So the rules of evidence are a lot easier to meet. Judges will pretty much take any evidence that could have a bearing. There's relaxed rules on hearsay. All the things that make life difficult in state court don't apply in Social Security. So use this to your advantage. That means if you have a former coworker who's willing to write out a letter to whom it may concern about your capacity for work, that can be very powerful evidence. And I have won cases where judges refer to that type of evidence being very persuasive to the judge about the person's capacity for work. So Social Security is insisting on ongoing evidence and extensive evidence and lack of gaps in treatment, but you can reduce the negative impact of that a little bit by relying on the informal rules of evidence and getting non-medical evidence that can really help your case. All right, I'm going to take a little bit of a break here, and then when I come back, we're going to talk about more in terms of the qualitative aspect of evidence and what you need to know about that and the trends I'm seeing in 2020 and beyond.
Don't know where to begin? Get my free Secrets to Getting Approved Survival Kit. Inside the kit, I discuss such things as, how do you know if you have a case? What to do if you're denied? How to avoid common mistakes? And my ever popular, how to avoid trick questions from the judge. Subscribing is free and easy. Just visit ssdanswers.com and look for the survival kit for instant access. Remember, time is eroding your position every day. Don't delay, act now. That's ssdanswers.com for your free survival kit. I am back now, and I want to continue my discussion, my thoughts about what we can expect from Social Security disability in 2020 and beyond. Before the break, I was talking a little bit about Social Security's insistence on extensive and current medical evidence and lack of gaps. I want to talk now about the qualitative aspect of evidence, what type of evidence they seem to want, and what they don't want. So I think one thing I'm seeing is Social Security judges and certainly the adjudicators are giving a lot less weight to evidence provided by family doctors and internists. They want to see reports from specialists. Now, realize that in 2017, Social Security made a change in the rules that got rid of something called the treating physician rule. In my opinion, this was a terrible policy decision. It was an overreaction, in my view, to the Eric Kahn case. If you're not familiar with what that was, Eric Kahn was an attorney, I think it was in Kentucky or West Virginia, and he basically had worked up a deal with local doctors and a Social Security judge and some other people in the Social Security system to basically fix approvals. And so he was getting cases approved just by the dozen, making a bunch of money doing so. But of course, it was fraudulent because the judges were getting paid and the doctors were getting paid. And eventually he got caught and now he's in federal prison. And so Social Security says, well, you know, the reason why Eric Kahn got away with this is that we are basically giving controlling weight of evidence to treating physicians. In other words, if you treated with a doctor for 3 or 4 years, what that doctor said about your work capacity, which is the fundamental issue in a disability case, that is controlling, that goes. And even if we have a Social Security consultative doctor that says something different, or a non-examining doctor reviewed your records and doesn't see the functional limitations that the treating doctors see, we have no choice. We have to approve your case because the treating doctor was on your side and in your favor. They got rid of this in 2017. And so now what's happening is every case that was filed after, I think it was sometime in March of 17, now these cases are coming up for hearing. And so what's happening is sometimes I'm going to a hearing, I've got medical records, 3, 4, 5 years of medical records from a doctor, and a judge can look at it and say, you know what, even though the treating doctor said X, I'm going to take the opinion of a consultative doctor who only saw this claimant one time for 45 minutes, or I'm going to take the opinion of a non-examining doctor who looked at the records at Social Security's request. This is a retired doctor who does this to make a little bit extra money, and this doctor decided that this person is not disabled, even though the 5-year treating doctor says that he or she is. As you can see, there's some real problems logically with that, but that's what the rules are. So we are seeing some cases, and I've had a couple of them. Fortunately, not too many. I've had a couple cases that were denied, even though the treating doctor was clearly committed to saying that this person has some significant work problems. Most judges, fortunately, are not going to deny your case based on a one-time 45-minute visit with a consultative doctor who probably works in an industrial clinic someplace who's got bias because they do mostly work for insurance companies and they don't find anybody disabled. And even less often do we see a judge who's going to say, well, this doctor who never saw you, I'm going to take his opinion over your treating doctor. I've had it happen a couple of times, but it's pretty rare. I think most judges will still give deference to treating physicians, but mainly if they're specialists. The big change here is that if your treating doctor is a family doctor, I think it's less likely that the judge is going to give that family doctor's opinion full deference. If it's a specialist, I think you're in pretty good shape. So, and if you think about it, it kind of makes sense. I mean, I've had cases in the past where a person went to a family doctor who diagnosed severe depression. The claimant is having severe anxiety and severe depression. The doctor prescribes medication. The family doctor prescribes medication and talks to the person every 5-6 months about their depression, and then issues an opinion that this person cannot work because of severe depression, problems with attention and concentration, emotional stability, pace of work, whatever the factors might be. Well, this is a general practitioner. This is not a psychiatrist. So judges are saying, you know, we don't think that a general practitioner has the knowledge or the expertise to issue functional capacity evaluation opinions for a person based on mental health when that's not what this person's specialty is. So it's much better if you're claiming a particular problem, and again, specifically with mental health, but it can be true with other things like fibromyalgia, autoimmune diseases, that you have a specialist. I've long said, in the case of fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue, CRPS, lupus, other autoimmune diseases, that you're much better off with a specialist, with a rheumatologist, with a specialist that deals with that type of problem, as opposed to your family doctor. Now, again, same question. What if you can't afford to go to a specialist? There's no answer to that. I'm just telling you that if you go to your family doctor and your family doctor diagnoses you with fibromyalgia and gives you Lyrica, and then issues an opinion that you're not able to work, that's not going to carry a lot of weight with Social Security disability judges. So less reliance on family doctors, more insistence and reliance on specialists. I think Social Security, another trend I'm seeing, judges in disability cases are putting a lot of emphasis on functional capacity evaluations from those specialists. Realize that a functional capacity evaluation, and these are forms that Social Security uses when they do evaluations, and these are also forms that attorneys like me will generate. I create my own almost for every case. And what it does is it asks the doctor to identify work limitations based on long-time doctor's visits and evaluations and testing and things like that. Doctors do this frequently in workers' comp cases and personal injury cases, so it's not at all unusual to ask a doctor to offer an opinion about somebody's capacity for activities of daily living or for working. And again, things that doctors are going to discuss would be reliability, meaning that this person need to take unscheduled breaks or miss days from work. They might talk about their physical capacity, lifting, carrying, climbing, reaching, stooping, things like that. Their capacity to concentrate, maintain emotional stability, all these things that go right to the heart of whether a person is capable of working. So I think that a functional capacity form is extremely relevant in a disability case, and it makes the judge's life a lot easier, quite frankly, by having the doctor translate medical issues, which is what the doctor's job is, into work capacity limitations, which is what Social Security wants to know. So if you can get a functional capacity evaluation, then again, this is something that lawyers will do, is we will put together forms for the doctor to fill out and answer questions if need be about what this question means, or if the doctor makes note in the record about certain functional limitations, those are things that make a real difference in Social Security cases. Again, a specialist, a functional capacity evaluation from a specialist who has seen you over time is going to be a lot more powerful, a lot more valuable than a functional capacity evaluation from your family doctor or from someone who saw you only once. But any kind of functional capacity evaluation, if it's reasonable and it's consistent with the record, that can be very helpful. And that's another thing that I'm seeing is that judges will sometimes discount these FCE evaluations by saying, well, the conclusions the doctor drew are inconsistent with what's in the medical record. And again, that's a tough thing to overcome. And why that happens, by the way, is that doctors, if you think about it, their job is to treat you and to help you get better. And so it's very hard for many doctors to put in the record that the treatment they're giving you is not working and that you're not getting better, you're getting worse, or the treatment they gave you not only made things not better, but it made things worse. So it's difficult for certainly physical medicine doctors to do that, but when they're asked to do an evaluation, they may say, well, this is the reality of what's going on, without having to flat out say what I've suggested or my treatment has not worked. So that's something we have to get past. But again, a good doctor will be realistic about your capacities and put it in both the medical records and the functional capacity form. That's, again, when I'm in a hearing, if a judge says to me, well, you know, why did the doctor not say this in the record? And there's several arguments you can make. Again, the gist of it is that the doctor doesn't want to position himself where he might get sued for malpractice because he did something that made things worse, or that he's not making things better. That's an argument that can carry some weight. Sometimes the doctor's notes about the person's status don't change over time. It's just part of a computer record. And I've been able to successfully argue that the doctor just kept using the same format, the same template, never changed it, even though what was going on was being changed. So there's a number of ways to get past that. But the bottom line is, if I have a good functional capacity evaluation, that's going to make my life a little bit easier. That's going to make my clients' chances of success to go up. All right, another trend I'm seeing, and this is a big one, we're going to see this for a long time, I think, is an increased focus on these continuing disability reviews and moves to terminate benefits. Realize Social Security has had some problems convincing judges to approve fewer cases. Now, they have the approval rates have gone down, but again, I think there's a reaction that judges, you know, if they're compassionate, reasonable people, are going to approve people who truly are disabled. So judges are somewhat independent. Social Security administrators can't do much about that. But what they can do is they can have the adjudicators at the non-judges, the claims adjusters, as it were, review the claims and decide, well, this person has medical improvement. This person's no longer disabled. And in fact, there is a suggestion that's being floated out right now to add a category of likely medical improvement to make these continuing reviews even more frequent. And I think what they're doing is they're saying, well, we can't stop judges from approving people for disability, but what we can do is on the back end, we can go back in and say, well, this person has improved. And they look at, you know, ongoing medical records. Has the person continued to go to the doctor? Because obviously now in many cases, they're going to have Medicare to cover it or Medicaid to cover it. So if you stop going to the doctor, you're going to be subject to a continuing review more likely than not. If you're younger, people that are in their 30s or 40s are going to see more of these. So Social Security is allocating more money to continuing reviews or hiring more staff to do them. And again, they want to try to cut people off on the back end. And, you know, one of the things that they do, which again, I don't know there's really an answer for this, but if you get a notice of potential termination, you have the right to appeal. And then what happens is you appeal, you file essentially a request for reconsideration. That's going to take 6 or 8 months. Then you request a hearing, and that's going to take another year. So you're probably 18 months from a decision. But you have to make a decision when you file your appeal or your response to the notice of potential termination. You can choose to have benefits continue while you appeal for that 18 months. But if you do that, there's no past due benefits, so you can't hire a lawyer in a contingency. Or you can decide the benefits will stop while you appeal it. And if you win, you'll get past due benefits, and you can hire a lawyer under a contingency fee, you know, contract, 25%, no fee unless you win. Of course, the problem is, if you have been only getting disability benefits for the past 3 or 4 years, you probably haven't saved a lot of money. You rely on those benefits to live. So you're asked to make a decision. Do I keep having benefits continue on, knowing that I won't be able to have a lawyer at my continuing disability review hearing, or B, I'll starve and have to rely on family and friends so I can hire a lawyer. Again, this is a back-end way for Social Security to cut people off because they feel like some folks are just going to give up and other people are going to have to do it on their own. And they don't know, of course, what to do as far as preparing a case for a hearing. And you're not going to know what to do when they get in front of a judge. This is a difficult, difficult problem. No solution on tap. So I will just tell you, if you get a continuing review, you should talk to your lawyer. You only have, I think it's 10 days, which is again, also ridiculous, 10 days to request that benefits continue, but you want to talk to a lawyer quickly, make a decision. Are you going to be able to afford to pay a lawyer either out of pocket, or you're going to agree to have your benefits terminated while you appeal and then starve for the next 18 months? Not a great choice, but that's the situation, and that's how Social Security is using continuing disability reviews to reduce people from the disability roles. And there's also been some proposals, by the way, to reduce attorney's fees. And I don't want to talk a lot about attorney's fees because that's not the problem of most people applying for benefits. But again, as an attorney doing this, it's got to be a viable practice area for me. So right now, the attorney's fees were paid 25% of past due benefits with a cap of $6,000. That cap has not been raised in over 12 years. So again, everything else goes up, but our fees have not gone up. And now proposals being floated around, let's reduce it to $3,000. Well, if they do that, guess what's going to happen? Attorneys are going to get out of the practice area. You're not going to be able to find an attorney, or the only attorneys who will take your case will be attorneys that think you have a complete slam dunk situation with your claim. And right now, I'm willing to take a case that's a little more questionable, and it's going to be more difficult. It's going to take more work because, again, if I win, I'm going to earn $6,000, but I'm not going to do that for $3,000 or $2,000. So this is another way they're going after claimants, is by making access to lawyers much less. So this is a trend that we're going to keep an eye on, and I hope that doesn't happen because I like doing this. But again, they cut the fees to the point where it's not viable, then I won't be able to continue doing it. There's also been proposals to make the GRID rules more difficult. Right now, the GRID rules, which is the medical vocational guidelines, this is where if you are over age 50 and you have a physical problem and you have less education and no work skills, you can be found disabled even if you have some capacity for work. Right now, that starts at age 50. The proposal is to make it start at age 55. So, and the Heritage Foundation would eliminate it entirely. So basically the GRID rules reflect the reality that people who are age 50 or 55 have a much more difficult time finding a job, entry-level type of job in the economy. If you make the GRID rule start at age 55, that means that people age 50 to 55, it's assumed they're going to have just as easy of a time finding an entry-level job as a person who's 25. You know, is that reality? No, but this is another way to cut off benefits. So, and then there's a final thing I saw, that there's a proposal to make inability to speak English no longer a factor. So right now, if you cannot speak English, and you're applying for disability benefits, your lack of English literacy is a factor that a judge or disability adjudicator can use to find you disabled, because the number of jobs out there for people who don't speak English is much less. And certainly within the GRID rules, if you're 53 years old and you don't speak English, trying to find an entry-level job is going to be very difficult. They want to eliminate that. Not speaking English will no longer be a factor. Again, this is just part of this trend that is anti-claimant. So that's, I want you to be aware of that. I will tell you, approval rates for the last 3 years have remained basically steady. It went from, I think 2016 was a 46%, 2017, 47%, 2018, 45%. So it's kind of stabilized around 45%. It had gone as low as 42%. Now it's probably stabilized a little bit closer to 45, 46%, a far cry from the 62 or 63% we had 10 plus years ago. So again, the trend is still very, very negative in that regard. You know, your chances of winning in a hearing are less than 50%. It doesn't mean you shouldn't try. It just means you need to have a lot of evidence and you need to be really prepared to make an argument to a judge. Some good news, the hearing backlog is down a little bit. The waiting times for a hearing have gone down a little bit, although the backlog at the administrative level, at the initial and the reconsideration, have gone up. So overall, there is a slight decrease in the delay. I'm not seeing quite as many cases that are more than 2 years old when we get to a hearing. There was a time when I was seeing claims that were 3 years old. Now it's closer to two, sometimes 18 months. I think that's going to continue to go down. I think that with the economy being strong, we see less disability applications. So the people that are there are able to handle the cases and move them through the system a little bit faster, which is a positive. But again, it's still 18 months is way too long for a case to take, and 24 months is way too long, even a year. I mean, if you have no money coming in, you have no access to medical care, that year can be very, very long. So again, I don't like to be pessimistic, and I think that this is a practice area that I find personally very rewarding. I think that people who are truly disabled, this is part of what our social contract calls for, is we need to help people who truly need the help. I will tell you, in my 30 years of practice, and probably 25 years of doing this kind of work, I see very, very few cases of outright fraud. Every once in a while, maybe once every 2 or 3 years, I see somebody who comes through that I just do not believe in. But for the most part, people, the last thing they want to do is to file for disability. They'd much rather be working. They have a socialization with work. There's a certain feeling of fulfillment to contribute to the household income. Nobody wants to sit at home for 2 years at age 53, hoping that the government's going to pay them disability benefits, 2 years down the road, with, judges that who knows what they're going to do. So I think that this notion that there's all this fraud and people are ripping the system off, I think that's really bogus. But again, that's the narrative being pushed. And right now that is seems to be holding the attention of many people in Congress. So that's what I think of what's going on in 2020 and beyond. Obviously, if things change, if we start to see some positive developments or hopefully not even more negative developments, I will let you know. But for right now, I would say that viable claims can still be won. It's just we need a lot more evidence, and we need to be aware that some of these trends are not in our favor, and just make sure that again, you ask for a live judge. Just do the things we have to do to really insist that if you are truly disabled, that you get the benefits that you've paid in for and that you do deserve. Until next time, this is Jonathan Ginsberg. I will let me know if I can help you, and we'll see you soon. Well, that's a wrap for today's episode. Subscribe to this podcast for regular updates at iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you found this podcast useful, then please give me a 5-star review, because it helps others see the value of my information. Thank you in advance. For a 100% free and confidential evaluation of your case, visit ssdanswers.com. That's ssdanswers.com. Don't delay. Act now.